Welcome to the Hub Roundtable. I'm Rudyard Griffiths, publisher of the Hub, joined as I am on each and every roundtable by Sean Spear, our editor at large. Sean, how do we find you today, the 29th of March, the opening of the Easter long weekend?
Doing great, thank you. We have my in-laws visiting, so we have a bit of relief from the day-to-day of childcare and heading into the long weekend feeling pretty good. How about you, Rudyard? I think you have a big dinner at your place tonight, don't you?
Well, luckily it's just drinks, Sean. With my family, you want to try to be surgical here, Sean. Get in and out in under 2 hours. I love them dearly. But yeah, we got everybody coming over, the cousins, the nephews, the nieces. It'll be a fun couple of hours later today. So we got to get through this podcast because I have to find a store that's actually open in Toronto where I can buy all the liquor that I'm going to ply my my relatives with. Talking about buying, I would just want to thank three big Hub fellows who joined in the last week. These are donors who are giving the Hub $500 for lifetime membership benefits. It's a huge shot in the arm for our operations. So Dee Paganelli, Jay Dinning, Kenneth B. I think we know who that is, a good friend. Anyway, it's terrific to see those Hub fellows coming on board and everyone who's responding to the campaign that we have underway, really stressing, Sean, how the Hub is committed to foregoing possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars in government subsidies, because we think the news and information, this podcast, everything we do for our listeners and readers should be produced by member donations, by advertiser dollars. We think government subsidy of news and journalism is a bad thing. Isn't that right, Sean?
Yeah. I mean, even just yesterday, Rudyard, we had the Toronto Star publish an opinion column by a member of PMO. And whatever one thinks about the substance of the op-ed, in a context in which the Toronto Star, like many other outlets, is receiving a significant share of its revenue from government subsidies, it prompts a question, I think, in a lot of people's mind, you know, was it in a position to decline that op-ed? And I'm not making a judgment about the people involved here. And you know, in fact, there may have been a good reason to ultimately publish it. But in a world in which a growing share of these outlets' revenues depend on the state, those questions are just going to inevitably be in the back of people's minds. And for that reason, amongst various others, we're really proud to have made this decision to, you know, live at the intersection of as you say, ads and sponsorship and reader support. And I'm glad that we're doing it.
Ditto. And I would just, my final point on this is that, you know, there's a federal election coming up in 18 months, and all of you, Sean and me included, will be news consumers in a media environment where by that point, probably the majority of most journalists and editors' salaries, including at private media news organizations, will be funded by one type of government subsidy or another. And where this, I think, becomes insidious is that those subsidies are the product of the policies of one party and one person, the Prime Minister of Canada. They are not the policies of the person and party who at this moment stand the best chance of replacing him. So just imagine that. Imagine what it's going to be like to have your news and information curated for you by journalists and editors looking around their newsrooms thinking, if that other guy gets into power, all these folks around this table are suddenly not going to benefit from the subsidies that the current guy in power is giving us. That is not good for democracy. It's not good for the media. It's not good for the credibility of the media as an independent source of kind of factual information. Anyway, enough of my carping about that, because I want to talk about your weekly wrap. This is the new note that you're writing for Hub subscribers exclusively. And the lead on your weekly wrap, published tomorrow in the Hub, is on the Ontario budget. And Sean, you and I agreed that this is a budget that needs some serious scrutiny. It says a lot, not just about Ontario's finances, but about the conservatism, and I'll put that in air quotes, of the Ford government. What's your top insight that you're gonna share tomorrow?
I think conservatives have been inclined to give the Ford government the benefit of the doubt over its now near 6 years in office. The premier seems like a nice guy. Many of us know people who either are elected members of the government or maybe work in staff positions. And so when it came to walking back major reforms when it with respect to deregulation and social assistance, many of us stayed quiet. When it was the Ford government's draconian and oftentimes nonsensical COVID restrictions, we stayed quiet. When it was the kind of small ball populism, license plates and beer and all of the other things that seemed to really animate the government, we stayed quiet. When it was the kind of petty corruption of the Greenbelt scandal, we stayed quiet. But I don't think conservatives can, on one hand, rightly criticize the Trudeau government's economic and fiscal agenda and the extent to which it's contributed to a lost decade, as we've written at the Hub, and on the other hand, continue to stay quiet when it comes to the Ford government. The budget tabled this week, Rudyard, shows the deficit growing, moving in the wrong direction. This year, it'll be almost $10 billion.
No, hold on. Let's just press pause here for a sec, because growing is a bit of a euphemism. I mean, this was a government, Sean, that a year ago was projecting a surplus, right? Or a very,
Yes.
very small deficit. And now $9 billion deficit, over $1 billion in interest costs. I mean, this is at spending at levels that are at or back to COVID highs over the Wynne government, which arguably they were elected on the basis that her spending was seen as irresponsible and out
Reckless.
of control, reckless.
Yeah, precisely right. And it must be said, Rudyard, that this is in a majority government context, far removed from the pandemic experience, with considerable distance before the next election. Like all of the typical arguments that one might wield to defend this type of deficit growth and debt accumulation just don't hold water. And in that sense, I think conservatives have to, if they're going to be principled, if they're going to, as I say, rightly criticize the Trudeau government for its spending and its deficits and its debt and the extent to which its big government thinking has become a burden on our economy, then you have to be prepared to call out the Ford government for precisely the same things. And so that's what my weekly wrap will outline tomorrow. I suspect that we'll get some blowback from some partisans, but ultimately, Rudyard, it seems to me the facts speak for themselves.
They certainly do. Look, I would classify this type of budget, which is now, being played out across Canada and Alberta and British Columbia too, as just outright fiscal incontinence. We know what the condition of incontinence is and what it requires. It requires wearing a diaper. And I think these are governments now, provincial governments, which are incontinent fiscally. And are filling their diapers with debts and deficits, which will burden future generations, the services that they can reasonably expect from government. It's already happening in education in Ontario, the extent to which this budget does nothing to reverse $500 million in cuts to post-secondary education. And don't fool yourself. Don't fool yourself out there thinking, as some rock-ribbed conservatives, Dofo's got my back. He's driving around a pickup truck, so everything's okay. These debts and deficits increase Ontario's borrowing costs. Ontario has the largest subnational debt of any jurisdiction in the world on a per capita basis. I believe it's over 80, I think it's approaching $80,000 for every man, woman, and child in the province. When you have this kind of out of control, profligate fiscal incontinence, it raises the cost of everything.
Yes.
Because when debt
As
servicing
Pierre Poilievre
costs,
has rightly argued.
when debt servicing costs become higher for governments, guess what? They become higher for you.
Yes.
Your credit cards will go up over time. Your mortgage renewals will go up over time. Your car loans will go up over time. because personal debt competes with the yields and what government can command in the market. If you have a lot of debt that you're issuing and you're a heavily indebted subnational government like Ontario, you have to offer investors more yield. So look, this costs all of us. Doesn't, you know, there was one prediction, Sean, that we published, or projection we published, that this budget was something, what, in the order of like $1,000 in related costs to people under the age of 45. If you even just think of the debt servicing of a $9 billion deficit on higher interest rates, right? We are living in a higher interest rate world, and this government is oblivious to it.
Yes.
And they are fiscally incontinent. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for them.
I agree with everything you just said. And the only other point I would make is that the rising deficit, the growing debt, these are the seen parts of the Ford government's failings. But what I'll argue tomorrow is, in some ways, Rudyard, the unseen parts are worse. This is a government defined by opportunity costs. If you step back and think about its accomplishment over now near 6 years of a majority government with an opposition and a weak opposition in disarray, with a re-election which in theory ought to have strengthened its capacity for policy ambition. We have an education system producing mediocre results, still shot through with left-wing identity politics. None of that's changed. We have a healthcare system collapsing around us due to the pathologies of the single-payer model. Nothing's changed. We have a regulatory system that is impediment to investment and much-needed projects. That hasn't changed. We've already talked about the fact that the Ford government's fiscal legacy isn't going to be reform. It's actually going to be overseen the further deterioration of the province's public finances. Crime is rising, taxes remain too high. I mean, the list goes on. It really does. Like, if you really think about it, if you force the premier today to say, what is his signature accomplishment? What is the legacy of the Ford government? I mean, I think the only thing you can...
Cheap beer?
Well, yeah, if you were going to steel man the argument, I think you could say he's won. You know, like the existence of the government itself is its major accomplishment. He manages to win a majority in 2018. He wins a renewed majority a couple of years ago. And according to polls, he remains, all things being equal, the most popular amongst the major leaders. But at some point, Rudyard, you know, we just had Brian Mulroney's funeral last weekend. At some point, the purpose of governing is a means to an end. It's not an end in and of itself. It's to accomplish something. And I think if the Ford government and the people in and around it were looked in the mirror and were honest with themselves, governing has become an end to itself. It hasn't become a means. And the consequence is all of these things that all of us thought, if only we could get in government, we would change, remain unchanged and arguably worse than when they took office in 2018.
Yeah, it was delicious. It's just, you know, 48 hours after the budget, out comes the sunshine list. So this is the list of all salaries of Ontario public service employees, over 300,000 now, making over six figures. It's fully 5%. I took a look. It's 5% of the entire adult workforce in the province is not only on the sunshine list, but is making six figures or more. At a certain point, Sean, we're just drinking our own bathwater, right?
Yes.
This economy becomes, this is the danger of these deficits that supposed, air quote, you know, conservatives in the Ford government, I guess, fail to understand, which is you are crowding out, you know, the dynamism, what's left of it. You're crowding out the private sector. I mean, if you're making a rational calculation sitting there as a person entering into the workforce saying, oh, on one hand, I've got guaranteed defined benefit pension, a pretty good track to a six-figure salary, and work at home. So maybe I'm in the office 3 days a week, I believe, is the provincial government's policy for workers in the public service. I understand compliance is a lot lower than that. Versus, hey, let's take a shot at the private sector where no job security, no defined benefit pension, you're in the office a heck of a lot more than your public service counterparts right now. The list goes on and on and on. Like these,
yes.
My point is that these deficits have consequences. They are unconservative. They're not unconservative simply in that they're fiscally incontinent, they're reckless, they're, you know, rolling the dice. Well, not only rolling the dice, they're undermining the future prosperity of you, our children, the next generation of Ontarians. They are unconservative because of what they do to our society, to our economic relationships, to
yes.
the fundamental structure of
yes.
the province. This is a, these kind of deficits, again, you're right. This is what we rightly criticize the Trudeau government for running year after year. And here they are in Ontario in full display, $9 billion, $1 billion in interest costs. Again, it's just, it's embarrassing. It's unconservative.
We increasingly have big government attached to an economy as opposed to the other way
yeah.
around, right? And, you know, we've spent a lot of time, as listeners know, thinking and writing about Canada's productivity challenges, flatlined or even declining GDP per capita, just a growing sense that we are less wealthy and dynamic than we used to be. And the points you just outlined are a crucial part of that story, right? Like if the government, Rudyard, is distorting the distribution of labor because it's pulling labor out of the productive parts of the economy into the unproductive part through a combination of overly generous compensation and benefits and auxiliary opportunities, and it's doing that with deficit finance dollars, then how can the productive part of the economy compete with that? And yeah. so it's enormously distortionary. As you say, if you're one of our best and brightest, going into the government is a rational decision in that context. And the consequences, again, to come back to this idea of opportunity cost, it's what we don't see. It's you don't see a dynamic graduate from the University of Toronto or somewhere else going into engineering or finance or the productive parts of the economy. They're going into the annals of the bureaucracy to work on regulations and all the rest that are actually going to extract value out of the productive part of the economy. This is a real problem. And I guess just to sum it all up, I think a lot of people thought that when Premier Ford was elected in 2018, he had a mandate to reverse those trends, to begin to chip away at those distortions, to restore balance between the public and private parts of our economy. And 6 years in, as the Shunsign list demonstrated, those distortions are worse. And many of the other things that I think people hope to see out of the Ford government have failed to materialize. We have a government that now exists for the purposes of being the government and not much else. And for that reason, even though, as I say, there's a lot of good people at Queen's Park, many people we know and like, I think it's time for conservatives, if they want to be principled about this, to say, you know, to basically call out the Ford government for what it is. And that, in my mind, is a failure.
Well said, Sean. Let's take a break. On the other side, we're going to talk the StatsCan numbers that were released this week showing our population nationwide grew by a whopping 3.2% in 2023. We're just on the cusp of 41 million. It's the highest rate of growth in over six decades. What does this all mean? What do these surging numbers represent in terms of a challenge and an opportunity? We'll have that conversation for you right after this short break. Hi, Hub Podcast listener, fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. This year, most major newspapers in Canada will join the CBC and fund the majority of their journalist salaries through one form of government-coordinated subsidy or another. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news consumers like you. This is why The Hub is not availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality, independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. This is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join at thehub.ca. Welcome back to the Hub Roundtable. I'm Rudyard Griffiths, publisher of The Hub. I'm joined by Sean Spear, our editor-at-large. Well, Sean, we saw some big numbers out of Stats Canada this week documenting Canada's runaway population growth. We added fully 1.27 million people between January 1st, 2023 and January 1st, 2024. Interestingly, the breakdown here, 471,000 immigrants settling. We can parse those numbers out because it's worth doing that to understand the composition of that immigrant group. But temporary residents rising by 804,000 in 12 months. What's your takeaway from these numbers?
Well, there's a lot to say, but maybe my entry point, Rudyard, is to sort of unpack something that you just outlined, which is we've had this significant population growth, the biggest since the mid-50s. But the major difference between population growth in the middle of the 20th century and population growth in 2023 is all of it is in the form of immigration. Because as we know, our fertility rate in 2023, the same year in which we experienced this massive growth, is at its lowest level similarly in decades. And I'm not making a normative judgment about immigration-driven population growth versus natural population growth. My only point is that there are important differentials between the two. Let me just outline a couple. The first is, just by definition, immigration-driven population growth is older than natural population growth. We've seen in the past couple of years that immigration has lowered our average age in the country on the margins, but just on the margins.
Yes.
It's not fundamentally...
The age structure of the total immigrant population, I'm not saying temporary student visas, but the immigrant population coming in under the point system or as refugees or through family reunification programs is very approximate to the existing rather elderly age structure of the population currently in the country at any one given time.
Precisely. The second other major difference between natural population growth and immigration-driven population growth is the latter is far more geographically concentrated. You know, that is to say, natural population growth broadly conforms to the pre-existing geographic distribution of our population, whereas we know, Rudyard, immigration-driven population growth is essentially happening in about five major cities across the country. The vast, vast majority is settling for understandable reasons in cities like Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. And so the consequence is it is placing, as listeners will well know, a lot of pressure on those places when it comes to public infrastructure, housing, etc. And it's really doing nothing to address, labor shortages, economic stagnation, etc., occurring in other parts of the country. So it's a very long way of saying, as important as it is to sort of look at the top line numbers when it comes to population growth, I think we need to understand that that there is something materially different about the population growing by 3.2% per year when it's being driven fully by immigration versus back in the 1950s when we had similar levels of growth, but the composition between natural growth and immigration was quite different.
Yeah, well said. I think my takeaway on these numbers is really twofold. One, the 804,000 temporary residents is just, it is a bonkers number. I mean, if we were not a supply constrained society, I would get it, right? Like if we had a ton of healthcare capacity and a ton of infrastructure capacity in the form of public transportation, if we had all the things that you would need to kind of juice your your temporary population by these kind of radical step changes. I get it. You might do it because it's a great economic boost. In effect, you know, GDP growth and the rate of immigration will roughly track one another one to one because you're adding to economic activity by bringing people into the country. You are consuming goods and services, and that's all good. Now, we can talk later about how that growth is kind of in some ways empty calories, and it has had pretty pernicious effects so far on our per capita GDP. But again, I question, Sean, this surge just seems so totally disproportionate to the reality of Canada today. Why do you think there's this disjunct between policymakers who surely understand, Sean, about the real constraints in Canadian society right now in terms of a whole series of social goods, yet they're allowing the country to be flooded? Like, this is not a vast majority of this is not illegal immigration. It's not a southern border with people streaming across it. These are temporary residents, primarily students, who are getting visas to come into Canada.
Yeah, isn't that a fundamental question, Roger? You know, maybe to put it differently, what happened? How did we make this collective decision? Did we make this collective decision?
Was it collective? But you've been in Ottawa, Sean, so I want, because just help us understand this. Like, is this a bureaucracy that's goal-seeking? You know, it gets an instruction down from the top, and then it just, like, goes off its own, and then the political staff are like, oh my God, what happened? Or is it a political staff who's saying, no, we want to try something really radical here, and these are your targets. We've made a decision. I don't know, the prime minister sat down with the immigration minister and the minister of human resources development, or whatever that department's called these days, and, you know, these are the targets, go out and execute them.
My sense is on the PR side. So the increase from an annual target of roughly 300,000 to now 500,000, that is an explicit political decision. The cabinet decided to do that, even though, Rudyard, we have evidence, which I outlined in last week's weekly wrap, that 500,000 permanent residents per year is actually not productivity neutral. You know, that is to say, the target of 500,000 a year is not empirically rooted. It reflects some other judgment, some sort of political decision. On the non-PR side, I'm kind of inclined, Roger, to think that this is a consequence of these demand-driven programs. You know, that is to say, the political arm of the government may not have actively decided that we were going to juice temporary foreign workers and student visas explicitly or intentionally, but because those programs are driven by demand, and we know that the universities and colleges have a kind of vociferous demand for more resources, these programs have just sort of gotten out of control without really any intentionality, in almost a sort of decentralized way.
Okay, reason that is a scary idea, Sean. You're basically saying that, you know, someone set up the program, opened the website, and then what, had a 6 month, 8 month coffee break, and then came back and refreshed their screen and said, oh, yikes, we've got, you know, 655,000 student visas that have been approved by our system.
I know that sounds unsatisfying and even kind of crazy, but the fact that we had this week Immigration Minister Miller announcing a significant reduction in student visas, you know, something approaching a third, is a sign that it's almost like the government was as surprised as many of us to discover that these programs have gotten out of control.
Well, Sean, let me be controversial here for a moment, because I enjoy that. Why a third? Like, where does that number come from? I mean, why not take it to zero? I mean, again, we are supply constrained right now across a whole bunch of important public goods in our society. You know, yeah, you're reducing it by a third. I guess that's a start. But my fundamental point, and again, this may sound uncharitable to people on Easter weekend, but these are not citizens of Canada. They are resident in another country where they are a citizen. They are not refugees. They are not applying to Canada because their lives are in danger or they are at risk of imminent death or harm. I mean, to state the obvious, we do not owe these people anything. Legally, philosophically, they are the citizens of another country who are trying to come here, frankly, to game a temporary educational visa, which becomes a pathway to citizenship, which our universities and colleges have decided to monetize.
Yes.
For pretty crass, funding gains in the light of what they perceive as the lack of provincial funding support for post-secondary education. I mean, why is this our problem? Take it to zero.
Yeah, you're not going to hear a big argument from me because of all of the things you just set out. I would also add, at the risk of a short digression, that Canada's immigration model, Rudyard, isn't very conducive to this type of proliferation of temporary non-residents. The reason being is that, unlike most countries around the world, we have something called birth on soil as a explicit policy. So that is to say, if one of these people comes here as a student or as a temporary worker or whatever, and he or she has a child in our country, that child is a Canadian citizen. And so it seems to me, once you've made the decision to have a policy of birth on soil, you really can't have temporary transactional relations with these people, because we are in effect committing that their kin will be Canadian citizens. As long as you have a policy like that, it seems to me the people that we are bringing here, we have to be prepared to make long-term commitments to, that there's a kind of reciprocal, there's a degree of reciprocity between us and these newcomers. We're not Qatar or these other countries around the world that have...
We shouldn't be. I mean, that's like a guest worker program.
Well,
right?
precisely. But so there is a kind of degree of incongruence between the rise of this temporary stream that we've been talking about on one hand, and the birth on soil policy on the other hand. But to come specifically to your point, I think it's something you said. Neither the federal government nor the provinces want to reckon with the fact that that we need to figure out how we're going to finance post-secondary education in this country.
I think it's unfortunate, Sean, even beyond that, it's a whole reality of economic growth, that we know that we're not able to achieve sustainable, durable economic growth through the usual preferred conduits of productivity gains or all the good stuff that could come with a more dynamic and entrepreneurial economy. No, instead, we're trying to have our cake and eat it too. We're trying to have an increasingly statist economy that continues with very low productivity, declining per capita GDP, but top line GDP. Well, we can goose that. We can move that up by simply moving population up. And the problem, as we know, is that you dump a lot of new people into the country, you create all kinds of disincentives for businesses to invest in the very systems of automation and capital equipment and other things that would drive productivity, because they can use the cheaper labor to facilitate whatever profit and earnings objectives they have. And that's what we know that they do. So this whole thing, to me is worrying, because it ties back in, it dovetails and vortices with these other larger trends that are really serious and substantive when it comes to Canada's long-term prospects, like our productivity, like our declining per capita GDP, and like these empty calories that we're getting in terms of a immigration-assisted economic growth. Am I right?
Yeah, well said. That's something we've written a bit about at The Hub, the distinction between extensive growth and intensive growth. And we've had a growth strategy now for several years that some combination of, as you say, population-driven economic growth, primarily through immigration, without even much concern for the type of immigration that's driving the growth. That seems like a secondary consideration. And the second, of course, is deficit finance cash transfers. That will increase GDP, I suppose, is a kind of arithmetic formula, but it does nothing to make us richer and better off. And so, you know, it's a funny moment, Rudyard, in which there's a whole set of evidence that's emerging, including Ontario's budget, that there's something kind of malfunctioning here.
Yeah.
And you know, it seems like policymakers have until now been resistant to recognize. And if I could just make a point, though, before I turn it back to you to wrap up, it's a point that I know we make oftentimes at the Hub, but it's just worth reiterating, is that, you know, all of the things we're saying about immigration policy is in part because we believe in the benefits of immigration. And so when we have policymakers, you know, basically taking Canada's immigration policy for granted, becoming kind of complacent about public support for the model, it gets our backs up because, you know, 800,000 temporary residents in the country without any consideration of the impact on rental prices in Toronto or other parts of the country, it seems to me is a recipe for ultimately a public backlash against immigration. And so shame on our political class for not protecting, you know, the hard fought public consensus in favor of immigration in our country.
Yeah. And the extent to which, immigration can and should be a really important and valuable economic driver. It's just not at these levels. I think that latest study that we published, was it from National Bank, Sean? I forget which,
Scotia
Bank, you know, around 350,000, newcomers a year seems to be about the optimal number in terms of creating, you know, incentives for corporations to invest in productive technologies and other things to more effectively utilize each unit of labor to make us richer. And instead, we're going in the other direction. I think maybe this is a topic for another show, but I think it just, you know, the two things we talked about today, the massive deficit spending in Ontario, this surging immigration levels, totally disproportionate to anything that's gone in the past, certainly in my lifetime. They're all frantic, in my view, government responses to the reality of anemic growth, that we have a really serious growth problem, and government either intuitively or directly understands that the fix is going to hurt, that it will not be popular to do what needs to be done to actually right the economy and make it more productive and more dynamic. It will require large scale cuts to government spending, pushing more of the productive human and other capital in the economy into the private sector. It would require reducing immigration substantially, getting rid of these kind of empty calories of GDP that immigration boosts. All this stuff is politically difficult, politically possibly toxic. So they don't want to do it. They're taking the easy route, high deficit spending, high immigration, to create this chimera of growth. And this is not what the country needs. So let's come back on that topic another day, because it's happening, you know, it's not just in Canada. This is, to be fair, this is a problem that's happening across a lot of the West right now. And I think it's one that really deserves our attention.
Yeah, well said. I guess, you know, one thing I've been thinking a bit about, maybe to presage something coming next week, listeners will be familiar with the inaugural Hunter Prize for Public Policy that we ran in 2023. Stay tuned for early next week for a major announcement about the second year, the 2024 year of the Hunter Prize for Public Policy. But at its core, Rudyard, Canada's a great country. Don't get me wrong, but we face some wicked problems that are going to require a break from the kind of groupthink that has marked the past decade or so when it comes to public policy in Canada.
Well said. Sean, have a terrific Easter long weekend. We'll do the Friday roundtable next Friday for your listening pleasure, as we do each and every week. If you're enjoying the program, please consider becoming a Hub supporter. You can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.com. Hub.ca. Check out Sean's weekly wrap in your Hub newsletter tomorrow, Saturday morning. Have a great Easter weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Atter Guzman. Thank you for listening.